Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy to have you along with us today. When people thinking about climate change and reducing carbon emissions, people often bring up the need for technological breakthroughs. Some experts say we have the tools and know-how that we need to drastically reduce carbon emissions, and that idea is the basis for a new game being played by school children, policy wonk, scientists, and other groups around the world. Dr. Roberta Hotinsky is a geoscientist turned science communicator who's worked at U.S. News and World Report, the National Science Foundation, and most recently Princeton University. As the information officer for Princeton's Carbon Mitigation Initiative, Dr. Hotinsky helped to develop the Stabilization Wedges game with CMI co-directors Stephen Pakala and Robert Sokolow. Now a consultant to CMI, she's presented the wedge concept and game to audiences around the world and continues to work with the group to develop wedge-related resources for educators and the general public. And we thank you very much for Dr. Hotinsky for spending time with us today.
Thank you very much.
When people think about this game, it's not like Monopoly and it's not like Scrabble. There's no fake money and there's no cards to swap.
No.
So tell us how this became a reality.
Well, the game started, it grew out of what we call our wedges concept, which I can get to in detail later. But it basically requires the players to build a portfolio of emissions, of carbon-cutting emissions strategies to cut emissions over the next 50 years. And so the concept itself of cutting the emissions had been developed by our co-directors, Steve Pakala and Rob Sokolow, and our corporate sponsor, we're a university industry partnership, and our corporate sponsors are BP and Ford. So for our annual meeting, one of our corporate colleagues had asked if we could come up with an interactive activity to sort of liven up the meeting. And so Steve Pakala is a big woodworker, and he went home and made these big wooden game boards, and that was our first wedges game. We had our corporate colleagues and CMI researchers got together in small groups to build these this portfolio of strategies, and then it proved so successful and word leaked out to other people about the game that we've continued it ever since.
It sounds great. If people have questions along the way, if you would like to share something, then join us in Madison at 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. Well, as we know, the world's carbon emissions keep going up and up. This game takes the projected increase for the next 50 years and slices it into 7 equal wedges. So continue with how the game is done.
Right. So the object of the game is to freeze emissions at current levels, so to avoid that projected increase. And so what we usually do is we break players up into small groups, and the wedges concept stems from a paper that was in Science magazine in 2004 where our co-directors said, let's look at the technologies that we have available right now and see how many of them could account for a substantial or could take a substantial chunk out of that projected increase.
Mm-hmm.
And they determined that there are 15 technologies or strategies already available today that could be scaled up to tackle that or avoid that emissions increase. And so what the players do is they sit down in teams, and then out of the 15 strategies, they pick 7 to build a portfolio to basically freeze emissions at current levels and keep them that way for the next 50 years.
And to give an example, I noticed that if you double the fuel efficiency of all of the cars in the world, projected 50 years from now, that would be a single wedge.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so if you like nuclear power, how would you get a single wedge with nuclear power?
To get a wedge with nuclear power, you'd have to add double our current capacity of nuclear power. That's the world's nuclear capacity. So the end result would be tripling our current nuclear capacity for one wedge of emissions reductions, and we need 7.
Then how about for those people who are enthusiastic about biofuels?
Biofuels, there's a wedge available from them using current technology. So assuming that we were using corn or sugarcane like they do in Brazil, that would take scaling up current ethanol production by about 30 times, and it would take using those current techniques, it would take a land area equal to about one-sixth of the world's cropland. So that would be a very land-intensive exercise. There are other possibilities that genetic engineering could increase the energy value of the plants, or that we could eventually get ethanol from municipal waste or wood residues. But at the moment, it would take about a sixth of the world's cropland.
So you've got various options. What we were just referring to is the option that includes renewable electricity and fuels.
Mm-hmm.
And that would include wind power, trading wind power for coal power.
Yes, exactly.
How many additional windmills would be required to reach the capacity that would be necessary to remove the coal-powered plants?
We'd need about 1 million 2-megawatt windmills, which are on the large side of what's being made today. So that, if we were to put all of them in one place, which, of course, wouldn't happen because this is for the entire world, but that area of windmills using based on current wind farm spacing would cover an area about the size of Germany.
Your focus is not on costs here.
No.
You don't worry about pricing. You're just worried about supplanting carbon emissions.
Right. Exactly.
We're talking with Roberta Hotinsky. She is a consultant, the former information officer for the Carbon Mitigation Initiative at Princeton University. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Let's talk a little bit about you and your background. You have a doctoral degree in paleoclimate modeling, I believe.
Yes.
Geosciences?
Yes.
From the Penn State University?
Yes.
And then went to work at Princeton eventually, mm-hmm. in the Atmospheric and Ocean Sciences program. What did you feel when you were asked to join the gamers?
Well, I really enjoy it. I've had a science background, but I've always had an additional interest in outreach and science writing, and so this has actually been a nice opportunity for me to combine those interests and get to work with people, you know, not work alone as a scientist, but to go out into the community and teach people about science that's really relevant to their futures and the future of the planet.
When we look at the various categories, and we mentioned that there were 15 different categories, efficiency and conservation offers what could be the greatest potential to provide wedges, as I understand it. Is that true?
Yeah, well, there are four wedges in the efficiency category. So there are a lot in renewables and biofuels and also in our fossil fuel-based strategies. But it tends to be, when we play the game, it tends to be what people pick first because it's familiar, for one thing, I think. And I think a lot of us can identify aspects of our own energy usage that we could certainly scale down pretty easily. So.
Well, how are we going to achieve these improvements in energy efficiency? Are there innovations that we're not aware of or that are coming online?
Certainly, a lot of what could be achieved is available really right now with existing technology. In the area of transport, we already have hybrid vehicles that get substantially better gas mileage than the fleet that we have today. In buildings, a wedge could come from if we used the best building practices available today in all commercial and residential buildings. That could provide a wedge worth of emission savings. And electricity production, as we build newer plants with the best available technology, and some new sort of near-term technology improvements that could be achieved relatively easily.
And in the option of improved fuel economy, we're talking about doubling the average mile per gallon of conventional fuel cars by doubling, let's say, from 30 miles a gallon to 60 miles a gallon. However, Congress doesn't seem to be able to get beyond maybe an additional 6 miles a gallon.
Well,
much less say 60.
Right. Well, that's something we need to work on. There are certainly all of the wedges have associate what we call challenges associated with them, and one is that there are people buy cars for things other than gas, for fuel efficiency or gas mileage. That's not necessarily the primary thing people are looking at when they buy a car. So also, it's a really long-term outlook. So I think certainly looking at short-term increases in efficiency is a start, but we'll have to go a lot further than that if we want to really look at stabilizing emissions at a safe level.
We're talking with Dr. Roberta Hotinsky, and let's take some calls. We'll start off with Dave in Manitowoc. Hi, Dave.
Hi there.
What can we do for you today?
I got a question about the wind turbine. It seems like Germany seems like a pretty small area to supply, you know, your slice of the pie.
Right.
When you figured out the number of wind turbines, did you figure it by capacity factor or, you know, what's possible if they're running 100%, or is it just because they don't run all the time?
Right, certainly. That's taking into account in intermittency. So that's about three times the amount that you would use using their peak output, assuming that they're running 100% of the time, to account for the fact that they're not always running.
Because, like, in Wisconsin, we figured out just for the 20% that we were trying to get, it would be like 7,000 turbines.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it seems like that's kind of a small number for the whole, you know, the whole world type thing.
Right. Well, I didn't do the calculations, but it's you know, a million windmills is a lot, and the U.S. is a big energy user. So 7,000 windmills is not really all that much in the big scheme of things. So.
Yeah, and that was just for Wisconsin I was
mm-hmm.
talking.
Right. Right.
Would that also one other question? Well, that's good. Well, interesting game. Thanks.
Oh, right.
All right. Well, thanks very much. Let's just sort of focus on this wind electricity. Mm-hmm. You have indicated, or I've read that it's indicated, that a wedge of wind electricity would require 50 times what we have deployed in wind power today.
Right. And that number keeps shrinking because we have to change it every year because the wind capacity keeps increasing.
And we would also have some of these windmills on land and some offshore. We don't have a lot of offshore windmill development at this time.
Right.
There have been attempts to, put them off of Massachusetts coast or mm-hmm. in that area, and you get a lot of reluctance to having that kind of density in someone's backyard.
Sure. And this goes sort of along with, it's another challenge that's presented to us, that wind electricity has a positive environmental benefit of carbon emissions reduction, but then any of these strategies, when they get scaled up, are going to mean that we're going to have to make some choices and decide how important we think carbon-free energy is. So certainly it's been embraced, wind electricity has been embraced in Europe and in Denmark, where they have offshore wind, but there certainly will be sensitive areas. And, of course, all this doesn't, you know, for example, Wisconsin doesn't have to follow all of these energy strategies. Each region can pick and choose what works for them.
We'll talk more with Roberta Hotinsky, a consultant, former information officer for the Carbon Mitigation Initiative at Princeton, New Jersey. I'm Jim Packard, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you along with us today. Rhonda Fanning is our on-air producer, and she will be reached in Madison at 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. We're talking with Roberta Hotinsky, a consultant to the Carbon Mitigation Initiative at Princeton University. And we're talking about a game that makes it possible for you to theoretically solve global warming. And you could find more information at princeton.edu and then search on Stab Wedge. In talking about the game, the creators, Robert Sokolow and Stephen Pikala, along with Roberta Hotinsky, set a goal of keeping global greenhouse gas emissions constant. They would hold atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide to about 550 parts per billion. Roberta, I believe that's about twice the level of the pre-industrial era.
Yes.
This would not stop global warming, but it would probably limit temperature change in what range?
Well, we're hoping that by preventing a doubling, keeping it below about 2 to 3 degrees Celsius rather than more.
This is no small feat, given that greenhouse gas emissions have been rising steadily with economic growth.
Well, exactly. But they haven't been rising quite as quickly as economic growth, because we do have increases in efficiencies that have been incorporated over history, where right now carbon is growing only at about half the rate that GDP is. So we've sort of decoupled carbon from that GDP growth, and we need to work more to even break that relationship down further.
Mm-hmm. Now, each of these seven wedges, they're like pie pieces. They represent 1 billion tons of reductions in annual carbon emissions by the year 2050.
Right, 1 billion tons per year by 2050.
So this is what happens when they play the game. If you're in a class, professors give students 15 wedges, different colors, each representing a way to achieve this 1 billion tons of carbon savings. Mm-hmm. And then they mix and match to be able to come up with a strategy for keeping those emission levels in 2050 equal to what we have in 2007. So the choices are, let's just go through them. What would happen as far as nuclear electricity production?
In terms of nuclear production, we'd have to triple our current capacity. So today there are about a little over 400 nuclear plants in the world, and about 100 in the United States. So we'd have to increase that by about three times.
And in terms of wind production?
Wind production would require 1 million additional windmills, and that's scaling up current capacity by about 40 times.
And halting deforestation and planting unforested land?
Right. So one wedge could be achieved from eliminating tropical deforestation, and to do it through planting new forests would require an area about the size of the contiguous United States. That could be distributed all over the world, of course, but it's a big area.
How about photovoltaics? What role will they play or can play?
Photovoltaics certainly have a big role to play. We'd have to scale up current capacity by about 700 times. The deployment of solar is kind of small right now because it's fairly high-cost technology, but it's certainly available today. And if we scale any of these wedges up, we're hoping that costs would go down relatively quickly as we learn.
And we've talked about the fuel efficiency of cars and light trucks. That would need to what?
It would need to double. The fuel efficiency of all the world's passenger vehicles would need to double over the next 50 years to achieve a wedge worth of emission savings.
How about exchanging incandescent bulbs with compact fluorescent CFLs?
That could take up about a quarter of a wedge.
And if you change the building codes, including in the developing world where most commercial building is occurring, what would occur there?
That would be using best available technology in all commercial and residential buildings, many of which don't exist yet. So it's easier to incorporate the new technology in the newer buildings.
We're talking with Roberta Hotinsky, who is a consultant to the Carbon Mitigation Initiative. It's the game we're talking about. It developed at Princeton University. And you came aboard in this project in the last couple of years. And how many times do you think that you've shown the game, played the game with participants?
I've done it about 15 times myself, and I've helped numerous people who have written to me or called and want help running the game themselves, teachers at colleges and high schools particularly, who want help in running the game in their own classroom.
So it's kind of a grassroots effort.
Definitely. We're not a big outfit at the Carbon Mitigation Initiative. It's about 10 core researchers and about 60 researchers all together, but we don't have a big outreach team. It's just me. So right now, the game has been so popular that we're rethinking our how we do our outreach effort, but right now it's been pretty much by word of mouth.
The number to join the program in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll free at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts about reducing these emissions? We'd love to hear from you. Russ is in Cottage Grove. Russ is next. Hello, go ahead.
Yeah, good morning. I'm curious of whether or not your game is actually controlled for population growth, so it's a variable in your equation. We're, what, at about 6.3 or 4 billion right now, projected to go to 10 billion. That's a 50% increase. Does your game control for that?
Right. Well, it's one of the issues in our game is that we don't really talk about what the assumptions are involved in that increase from 7, and we're emitting 7 billion tons per year right now, to increasing that to 14 billion tons by 2050. That falls in the middle of a field of a bunch of different estimates that make a bunch of different assumptions about population, about what kind of energy we're going to use. And so our game basically says we'll look at the trends of the past 30 years and project those into the future. So assuming population growth in line with what we've seen in the past. But certainly a wedge of emissions savings could come if we have a significantly smaller amount of people on Earth. Right now, we have about 7 billion tons of carbon that we're emitting and 7 billion people on Earth. So each of us is responsible for about a ton of carbon per year. So you can think about it that way. If population were a billion, if we had a billion people fewer than is projected for 2050, then that would be a billion tons of carbon per year being avoided in one wedge. And right now, incidentally, Americans are responsible for about five times the emissions of the average citizen, so about five tons of carbon per year.
And altogether, Americans currently account for about half of the world's greenhouse gas emissions?
About a quarter. Yeah.
Now, how do we take into account some of the fast-developing countries like China and India, where these emissions per person are kind of a fraction of what they are for the average American?
Well, that's a difficult question, because if we freeze emissions at current levels, it's going to be certainly a difficult task to stop, to avoid emitting more than we emit today. And so if the developing world is allowed to increase its energy use at all, it means that for those of us in the developing world, we'll have to reduce our emissions. So basically, we're going to have to come to some sort of agreement as to what's fair, how much the developing economies can grow while the developed countries still pursue economic growth.
It's my understanding that when setting up the game, it was considered that these emerging countries would generate 60% more greenhouse gases by 2050 than they do now. And then as a sort of a consequence of that, industrialized nations like the United States would have to cut their emissions by 60% in order to balance that out.
Right. That's it's been a more recent calculation, but yeah, the developing countries would have to reduce our emissions further. But we also have the advantage of strong research and development community, and a lot of progress already in this front. So hopefully this isn't such an idealistic target, hopefully it's a realistic target. And I'd also like to point out, we don't talk about costs too much, because we assume that eventually there will be a mechanism put in place that will allow the decisions of what wedges will be pursued to be market-driven, but we assume that about all of these technologies could be put into place for a price of about $100 to $200 a ton of carbon, which is comparable, the lower end is comparable to current subsidies for nuclear and wind power. So it certainly will have a cost but as we move forward, but we don't think it'll be that catastrophically disruptive for the economy.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Roberta Hutinsky, who is a consultant, former information officer of the Carbon Mitigation Initiative from Princeton University. And let's go to Jim in Eau Claire next. Jim, what's on your mind today?
Hi, yes, thanks for the program. I'm wondering if you know anything about thermopolymerization as a way to make fuel oil.
I don't know anything particularly about that. From what kind of source?
It will take any waste or any product that's biological above ground,
mm-hmm.
including human waste and garbage and everything.
Right. Well, certainly I know that there's a lot of research being done into better ways to get fuels from organic sources. And so right now with our calculations with ethanol, it's very land intensive, but new technologies like making ethanol from cellulose and other technologies like this certainly can play a part, and it would be great to get fuel from municipal waste, but those are sort of a not ready right now kind of technology. So what the purpose of the paper was responding to a lot of people who said we really need a lot of advanced technology to tackle this problem, and we're saying, no, we have technology now that could be scaled up, but certainly if we can get more efficient processes for producing things like biofuels, that would be a great boon to the effort.
This produces oil, actually, and it's a low-carbon or non-carbon oil because it comes from material above ground.
Right, but there's still going to be the carbon in the oil itself.
But about 80% less than there is now.
Right.
Okay.
All right, Jim, thanks very much for pointing that out and for bringing it up. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have a couple of lines open. In Madison, the number is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. In line with new technologies, I know that Princeton had the coal fusion project that it was quite high on a few years ago. Have you heard any more about successes there?
No, we have a whole research lab associated with Princeton that's working on high-temperature fusion, and that, I know, proceeds. I'm not so familiar with the fusion technologies and the progress.
Let's go to John next in Onalaska. John, what can we do for you today?
Well, I have a question. Are you assuming that the solar energy is bouncing off the Earth's surface and is being trapped by CO2 and thus causing the problem of greenhouse effect?
Yes.
And what I have a problem with here is I have read that the solar energy bouncing off the Earth's surface is only responsible for, CO2 is only responsible for 1,000th, per one out of each 1,000 parts of the solar energy bouncing off the Earth's surface. So the rest of it is absorbed by the water vapor in the first 30 feet of the Earth's surface, of the troposphere, the layer next to the Earth's surface.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you say to that?
Well, I'm not sure about the first 30 feet of the Earth's surface, but certainly water vapor is the most important greenhouse gas. The Earth has an atmosphere that keeps it much warmer than it would be if it had no atmosphere. So, for example, the moon has no atmosphere, and when it's not in the sun, it gets extremely cold. So our atmosphere does act like a blanket. And the effect, the CO2, has a smaller impact than the water vapor. But the problem is the carbon dioxide is putting us out of balance. So it's adding incrementally a more heat-trapping capacity. And so more of the sunlight that comes in gets trapped, and the Earth has to heat up to get back into balance. So right now we've increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere about 35% relative to where it was prior to the Industrial Revolution because of our burning of fossil fuels. And so we continue to add to the heat-trapping capacity of the atmosphere, and over time it's adding up to be a fairly large effect.
Do you disagree with the idea that one one-thousandth of the trapped energy is from CO2, only that small amount, and that makes the biggest difference? That doesn't make sense to me.
Well, it's not got to do with the relative amount of water vapor in the air versus the CO2, because the CO2 is only a few parts per million. It's more about the heat trapping capacity of that CO2, and it's very effective at trapping heat. So it may seem like a small effect, but overall, if you look at the atmosphere and what we call the radiative forcing, the way that the CO2 traps and re-radiates that heat, it's a big effect.
It's hard to believe that thousands can be one out of every 1,000 parts trapped by CO2 makes a bigger difference than the amount trapped for from water
Well,
vapor?
it's not a bigger difference. It's that the water amount of water vapor in the atmosphere is large, and then this is just an additional effect that we're adding to it. Right now, the greenhouse effect, I think the temperature of the planet would be like negative 15 degrees Celsius if we didn't have an atmosphere at all, and instead it's about positive 15 degrees Celsius. So there's a big effect of like 30 degrees Celsius or roughly 60 degrees Fahrenheit that's from water, and this is an additional effect from carbon dioxide that's warming the planet gradually, and it's just building up with time.
Thanks very much, John, for your call. Appreciate hearing from you. And we have a couple lines open. If you have a question that you would like to share, in Madison, the number is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. When you look at global CO2 emissions, they come from three broad end-use sectors: power generation, transportation, and direct uses of fuel in industry and buildings. I believe the greatest amount of those emissions comes from power generation.
Yeah, it's roughly a third, you know, divided into thirds. Transportation is a little bit smaller than a third, but then it's roughly equally distributed between electricity and direct fuels.
And you see a great effect coming from energy conservation measures in each of those areas.
Yes.
For instance, in power plants and household appliances and in airplane engines and city planning and in steel mills and materials recycling, and all of that is underway at this point.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting. Through this work, I've found out all sorts of interesting statistics, and one is that 70% of electricity, which is mainly generated from coal, which is very carbon intensive, 70% of that electricity is used in buildings. And so increasing the efficiency of our buildings is a really good way to save some of that electricity or use it more efficiently.
How are we going to get this kind of multinational cooperation that will be needed to develop this kind of plan for all the countries?
We try to stay out of being too policy prescriptive. We talk about what's feasible, and then let people go from there. Certainly, it seems that the mood around the planet is changing and that people are becoming more serious about addressing climate change, and that also businesses are starting to see this as an opportunity. We have two corporate sponsors, Ford Motor Company and BP, and they see it not only as, you know, something to be that's going to put regulations on them, but also as an opportunity for them to develop new businesses. So I think as people's attitudes about climate change, you know, start to evolve, and they see this as something that is serious, that needs to be addressed now, and that there are all sorts of opportunities and advantages to addressing climate change, things will turn around. There's also a new recognition that energy security and the health impacts of coal-fired power, for example, are complementary to the goals of climate change. So the debate is not just about climate anymore. It's also about public health and about energy security and agriculture and all sorts of issues.
We're talking with Roberta Hotinsky, who was the information officer for Princeton's Carbon Mitigation Initiative and now a consultant. She helped to develop the stabilization wedges game with CMI co-directors Stephen Pikala and Robert Sokolow. And now a consultant to CMI, she's presented the wedge concept and game to audiences around the world and continues to work with the group to develop wedge-related resources for educators and the general public. We'll take more of your calls in just a moment as we continue talking with Roberta here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Kathleen Dunn. Glad to have you with us today as we continue talking about solving the climate problem for the next 50 years with Roberta Hotinsky, who is a consultant to the Carbon Mitigation Initiative at Princeton University. Let's go back to the phones, and we'll take Mike next in Oshkosh. Hello, Mike.
Good morning. Oh, I've had you on speaker there. While
there
I'm
you
waiting.
Are.
Yes, Jim. There's a point here that I have not heard addressed before, and that is the gentleman that was on a little while ago was saying, oh, the CO2 is just such a small fraction of the total problem, and when you burn fossil fuels, you give off CO2, but you know what else you give off? is H2O. And these people, sorry, I can use the term these people, but people that poo-poo the idea of global warming, no one has brought up the fact that when you burn fossil fuels, you also give off water vapor. And this is what they're saying is the major contributor. Well, when you burn fossil fuels, duh, gives off H2O in addition to CO2. Would your guest care to comment on that?
That's correct. When you combust hydrocarbons, you do get water. The thing is that the concentration of water vapor in the atmosphere is so much larger that the relative contribution of water from fossil fuels is going to be small, relatively small. And but there are, in the future, it's projected that water vapor is going to increase in the atmosphere as we get warmer, because warmer air effectively holds more water. So there will be warm water vapor in the atmosphere. So that effect is probably going to be larger. So the water vapor concentrations are increasing both from burning the fossil fuels, but I think that is maybe still evolving, but I think it's relatively small relative to the effect of warming and the increased water vapor that's going to go into the atmosphere just because of that.
Well, just as every little bit helps, every little bit hurts also.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mike, thanks for pointing that out. We appreciate hearing from you. Let's go next to Mary in Janesville. Mary, what's on your mind today?
Well, after I saw Al Gore's movie, and by the way, thank you for this wonderful program, after I saw the movie, there's a recommendation, on the CD about a website that you can go to determine your own carbon footprint. So I did that, and I was completely blown away by what I consider myself a greenie, and I drive an older high mileage car that gets really good gas mileage. I get like about 32 miles to the gallon, but it's still a gasoline car. I know I'm a polluter, and yet we're talking about our homes being the major polluter. I'm out here on the interstate every day. I'm on the interstate right now. There are cars whizzing by me on every side, and I can't believe in my heart of hearts that this isn't a major problem here. I guess I'm just not understanding how this could be the lesser of the problems. Could you address that, please?
Sure. It's certainly not a less. It's one of the problems, and so there is a wedge available from just passenger vehicles. So transport is about responsible for about a third of the emissions we have today. That includes planes and freight transport and passenger vehicles. So passenger vehicles themselves are not. A huge sector of the whole carbon emissions picture, but they are a very big issue. If you drive an average car about 10,000 miles per year, then you're responsible for putting about a ton of carbon into the atmosphere. That's similar to the amount that comes from flying 10,000 miles a year as an individual. You're responsible for about a ton of carbon if you flew that far. It's comparable to what you would use, the emissions from heating your home for a year, for an average home using natural gas. And it's also comparable to what you put out in the energy, the carbon in the emissions from lighting your home. So certainly driving is a big part of the picture in an overall sense, and certainly in our lifestyles, and driving and flying together make an even bigger impact.
I guess my point is here, when I realized I put over 20,000 miles a year on my car,
mm-hmm.
I'm a commuter. I commute to Madison from Janesville every day, and I'd love to do something to stop it. What I'm trying to do is get transferred back to Janesville, but the point is, I'm sitting here alone in my car, and I remember in the 60s, and I'm not a kid anymore. I remember in the 60s the carpoolers, and I know that there are carpool lanes in the big cities. And I'm thinking to myself, there should be a way that people like myself can find access to other people who are going back and forth from my community to the community where I work every day, spend an extra 15 minutes on each end so that we can get together. What's wrong with carpooling? I mean, we haven't made some of the most basic changes in our lifestyles because we don't want to.
Well, certainly, and that's a lot of that is a function of the energy has been relatively cheap until fairly recently. During the energy crisis of the 80s and in the early 90s, when oil was more expensive, people bought smaller cars. There were investments by the government in coal seam fuels and lots more interest in efficiency. And then whenever energy gets cheap again, it's not as pressing for people to do it or to do the research or to set up that carpool lane. So probably until with the current oil prices, there's certainly some motion toward making some changes. But in addition, if there's a price on carbon that's coming down the pike in the future, I think as people realize or see a bigger impact on their pocketbook, those kind of changes are going to come about. So it takes efforts from the individual level, like yourself, and also from policymakers in each region to encourage the kind of behaviors that will reduce carbon emissions.
Mary, have you tried to join the state carpool?
No, actually, I don't know anything about that.
Well, I know that they carpool to Madison from various cities, and I noticed that on the vans, if they're using vans, it'll say that you do not have to be a state employee to take part in this.
Really?
So I think if you just Googled Wisconsin state employee carpool, I think you'd probably come up with a number at least to get some information on.
Thank you so much for that information. I really appreciate that because I'd really like to be able to do something positive here.
All right, Mary. Thanks very much for the call and for bringing up that point. Let's go to Jason next in La Crosse. And Jason, what's on your mind today?
Hello. Thanks for the program. I've taken a couple of college courses on the environment. And from what I understand is northern climates have locked away permafrost, such as in Canada and Siberia, in which it hasn't been unlocked for thousands of years before human history. But now that the climate is starting to change and the temperature is rising, this permafrost is being unlocked, which contains methane and has about four times the effect of carbon dioxide in it. So with the rising temperatures, that becomes a problem. As well as I've heard some scientist studies saying that there will be no more summer ice in the Arctic by as early as 2025, around there, so that won't allow sunlight to reflect. What are your take on these two subjects?
Those are both really important factors, and that's one of the examples in client, or two of the examples in client science about feedback mechanisms. So we have the initial warming that's being predicted based solely on the carbon dioxide concentration that's going to be in the atmosphere. But then there are these other effects that might be caused by the initial warming that could make it much, much worse. So certainly those sorts of issues are what make the push for cutting emissions right now so important. We think that if we can keep our atmospheric carbon dioxide from doubling from the pre-industrial level, that will be sort of a safe level, or that will avoid the worst predicted impacts of climate change and be able to save some of the permafrost and the sea ice. But it's not an exact science, so it's hard to know how those feedbacks are going to work. So certainly, this is a good time to mention, too, that the target of the wedges game is to keep emissions at about 500, or not emissions, but atmospheric concentrations of CO2 at about 550 parts per million. But we certainly could go lower than that. We could be more ambitious and be even safer. 450 parts per million is a target that's been projected. We're about 380 right now, so we'd really have to be ambitious to keep it at 450 parts per million. But then also, in order to stabilize CO2, eventually our carbon emissions are going to have to go down to very small levels because we want to stop adding carbon to the atmosphere. So beyond 2050, which is what the end point of the game, we need to further reduce emissions reductions after that. So there's lots of work to be done and lots of research and development to make sure that we avoid some of these further consequences of climate change.
When people are playing the game, the Carbon Mitigation Initiative, they're given, as I think, 15 options.
Yes.
Let's just review those options for people who might have joined us since we talked about that. The first option, improved fuel economy. What are you looking for there?
We're looking to double the fuel economy of all the world's cars by 2050.
And a reduced reliance on cars and automobiles.
If we were to cut all the miles, the vehicle miles traveled by all passenger vehicles in half by 2050, that would account for a wedge.
So we need a increased reliance on mass transportation.
Right, and plus new technologies for telecommuting and doing video conferencing. There's lots of trips that are not necessarily necessary. So working on ways that people can work together without actually being together would also be a big help.
Option three involves more efficient buildings.
Right, using the best available technology in all new and existing buildings, including insulation, lighting, and heating and cooling, could account for a wedge in emission savings.
Improved power plant efficiency.
Right. So if we were to raise plant efficiency from 40% to 60%, these are the electric generating power plants, then that would account for about a wedge worth of emissions. Right now they're at about 32% efficiency. So that's projecting that in 50 years they'd get to at least 40, and then we'd have a further increase in efficiency.
And we have the technology today to be able to increase the 40% efficiency to 60%?
Right, with technology available today, using the best that we have, and then near-term improvements in technology.
Option five is substituting natural gas for coal.
Right. It's if you make electricity from natural gas versus coal, it only provides about half the emissions that coal does. Coal is much more carbon intensive. So if you switch from the same, if you had 1,400 natural gas plants, that would give you the same electrical output as 700 coal plants with the same emission, or twice the emissions of 700 coal plants, but with the same amount of emissions.
Mm-hmm. Option six involves the storage of carbon, which is captured in power plants.
Right. This is called carbon capture and storage, or carbon capture and sequestration. That's the one many people are not familiar with. If you have large point sources of carbon dioxide, like a power plant or a plant that makes hydrogen, then you can capture the CO2 at that plant, and instead of releasing it to the atmosphere, you can bury it underground. And so that's been proposed and is going on in pilot projects around the world right now.
How does hydrogen production from fossil fuels figure into this?
Right. Well, lots of people talk about the hydrogen economy and hydrogen, using hydrogen in cars and power plants, because when you burn hydrogen, all you get is water vapor, which we've discussed is a greenhouse gas, but you're adding that to the atmosphere at a relatively smaller proportion than you are with CO2. And so if we move to the hydrogen economy, you can either get hydrogen from water using electricity. So you could use renewable electricity to make hydrogen, or you can fossil fuels are hydrocarbon fuels. They have hydrogen in them. So you could take hydrogen from a fossil fuel like oil or coal and then use that hydrogen. The problem is, what do you do with the carbon that's left over? And so if you release it to the atmosphere, then there's no climate effect to using hydrogen. So if you were to get hydrogen from fossil fuels, you'd need to capture the carbon once you've stripped off the hydrogen and then bury that underground.
And that would require the same thing in a syn-fueled plant, for instance.
Right, exactly. A lot of talk has gone on about making syn-fuels, like gasoline from coal, which has been done before in the past, but that also has a bad climate effect. It provides about twice the emissions of using normal petroleum fuels. So you can capture the CO2 that's released in the refining process and bury that under the ground, and then it would be no worse than petroleum fuels. It would be about the same as the oil we use today.
Option nine involves nuclear fission.
Right. We'd have to triple the world's current nuclear capacity.
Option 10 involves wind electricity.
Right. We'd have to use about 1 million additional windmills to create enough electricity for one wedge.
And we talked about photovoltaic electricity before, where you'd need an area roughly the size of New Jersey.
Right.
In this country or worldwide?
Worldwide.
Worldwide.
And a lot of that with solar, you can also, if you're using photovoltaic cells. You could also put those on rooftops and things, so it doesn't have to be land area exclusively dedicated to solar.
Renewable hydrogen.
Right. You can get hydrogen, like I said before, from water using electrolysis. You split the water molecule and get the hydrogen out of it. So for wind hydrogen, you would need about twice as many windmills to get a wedge from wind hydrogen as you would from wind electricity, so about 2 million windmills.
Biofuels, what's the word there?
We'd have to scale up our current production by a factor of 30, but that's increasing very quickly. The United States has doubled its ethanol production since 2001, so that's going on. But eventually, it's very land-intensive right now. That might change, but right now it would require about a sixth of the world's cropland.
And forest management and agricultural soils management are options 14 and 15.
Right. We could halt deforestation in 50 years, and that would be a wedge, or we could use conservation tillage on the world's agricultural soils. Those are techniques that try to keep carbon in the soil instead of turning it over and letting carbon escape to the atmosphere. If we were to do that on all the world's soils, there would be a wedge of emission savings available.
How can people get more information about the game and about what's going on there at Princeton?
Oh, well, we have a website. It's www.princeton.edu/TildeCMI, or you can just search on Carbon Mitigation Initiative, Google Carbon Mitigation Initiative or Stabilization Wedges, and we should come up. We have materials for the game available on the website and papers about all our latest research on the website as well.
Well, thank you so much for spending this hour with us. It's been very interesting. Do you have plans to come to Wisconsin soon?
Not soon, but nobody's asked me yet.
All right. Well, maybe they will. Dr. Roberta Hotinsky, a geoscientist turned science communicator. She was the information officer, is now a consultant to the Princeton's Carbon Mitigation Initiative. It's been very interesting, and perhaps we'll follow up on this as things move along. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air phone production. I'm Jim Packard. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.